You're listening to FemLonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and today we're talking about the most recent Democratic presidential debate. One of the great perks about running this podcast by myself is I can talk about whatever the heck I want. So we're taking this opportunity this week to put all of our thoughts on the table about all 20 plus candidates for the Democratic primary elections in the US. And we're joined by Chris Martin, who is one of the founders of the Ontario Loud podcast. We love that podcast, so great to be able to hash out some of these thoughts with Chris. This is, I think, our longest episode ever, so this will be our record. But I thought I would just leave it as a really raw conversation between Chris and I instead of, you know, editing and cutting it down. So I really hope that this is interesting and valuable to you, particularly if you haven't really been following the US context. We don't talk a lot about US politics, so this was a kind of fun and refreshing exploration, I guess, into the topic. So definitely let us know if you want to hear more about US politics. But I'm not going to talk too much longer because, like I said, this is our longest episode ever. So enjoy. Thanks so much, Chris, for joining. I'm really excited to jump into the Democratic debates from a bit of a perspective of how some of the topics relate to Canada. Hopefully we'll get into a bit of a smart discussion with also some rants.
I mean, rants I can promise. Smart, I am we'll wait and see.
Oh, totally. I know the feeling, but I'm excited to chat with you as somebody that hosts a political podcast as well based in Ontario. I think it'll be kind of an interesting lens to the debate.
Yeah, no, I'm super pumped and really, really excited to be here, Katie. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Okay, so first, what I want to do is basically there were two nights, so maybe just jump in a little bit to night one. Then we can talk a bit about night two, and then we can like dive into some of the policy. Okay, so hilariously, I am trying to find the full list of like the candidates from the first debate, but now that everybody is like has their commentary up, the actual list is not readily available.
That's actually such a good distillation though of the moment that we're in. We are in such a culture of hot takes and punditry that, like, as the debate was rolling, you could read from, like every major news source, the, like, all of the editorial staff commenting, giving their hot takes on it, on what was happening. And, you know, I feel like we're, like, the sort of the meta commentary about the debate has now actually reached the point of almost eclipsing what the candidate said about actual policy in the debate. And so I feel like that is just like really? Who was in the debate? Like, if you search debate, you'll figure out who won the debate based on people's opinions, but you will not figure out who actually was on the stage.
Totally. Well, and actually, you know, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. Maybe let's start by talking about that, like talking about the fact that there were 20 candidates that qualified for the debate. And then again, they broke them up into two nights, 10 and 10. But this is not something we would ever see in Canada. Like, I'm trying to remember the largest kind of stage that we would have seen. And I guess actually the Conservative leadership, just the federal Conservative leadership did have a lot of candidates. So we saw some of that maybe recently, but even so, the ideas that were kind of debated were not nearly as like different and diverse as what we're seeing on the Democratic stage right now. So I think that's an interesting lens to look. Like, why are all these candidates here on the stage?
Yeah, no, and I mean, per the format, I don't know about you, but I found both evenings, and full disclosure, I only watched a bit of the second evening because I found it totally exhausting. And I love politics. Yeah. I've always been interested in politics. I've always loved watching debates. But I think, the nature of a race where you have 20 different candidates, and like you know, to be real, most of whom don't have a serious shot at actually winning, but where I guess the goal of the evening is everyone vying for attention and for that soundbite. It's like an exhausting spectacle to see. And actually, like, I vividly remember, because I think I was like, I was talking with you over Twitter, and like, I was like, I was feeling a little relieved when the second hour was running. I was like, okay, they're going to wrap up now. And then it just kept on going. And then I just remember there was a whole second night of this, just like people jumping in, interrupting, everyone usually going after the front runners. Like, I am very glad that the next debate is going to be winnowed down a little bit, because I think it distorted in some ways what this race really looks like.
Couldn't agree more. And I think such a like perfect example of that is the fact that they have taken basically the way this debate was set up. They divided the four front runners in half. So on the first night, we had Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Second night, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. But what ended up happening, at least in the first night, particularly, was Elizabeth Warren spending all of her time debating John Delaney, who like nobody has ever heard of before. So that, I thought, again, was just so interesting, because you've got, you know, Biden polling at like 15 points above the other three really right now. But two of those four frontrunners didn't even get a chance to challenge his ideas or present their ideas on a stage with him. So I think that is like the particularly interesting thing. And then even the topics that came up in the two nights were different in some cases as well. So you get 10 candidates who aren't able to, you know, weigh in to really important topics because they didn't even happen on that stage.
Found really and the role that CNN played, I thought, was like I was frustrated by NBC and, you know, sort of the raise your hand if you support X kind of questions on complex policy stuff. I think they were rightly criticized for that. And so I was kind of looking forward to more to the CNN debates, because they said they wouldn't do dumb stuff like that. But they actually, I found it was the voice of CNN was equally bad in a different way, where I think because they set their goal as they wanted to sort of push a narrative of, you know, and draw distinctions between the candidates, which and push a narrative kind of moderates versus progressives, which we can get into. They, you saw the moderators, both in the way they phrased their questions, sort of echoing the Republicans' talking points about raising taxes and healthcare and that kind of stuff. And then they would also always go back to your point, John Delaney, who is polling less well than Marianne Williamson. So, you know, 0% chance that we're ever going to see John Delaney in a debate again. But they kept on going back with him because he has said the most negative things about the other candidates' proposals. And Tim Ryan, I think, is in that in that category too. So, yeah, just like, I mean, the voice of CNN or their framing choices was really strong on that stage, and I think did a lot to push a narrative of you know, divides in the party that might not actually be as real as they seemed on stage, just because.
Yeah, totally. I found that very weird too, like basically being like, you know, again, that great example, John Delaney, you've said that Elizabeth Warren's plan on X is terrible, explain. Or like, and just like that divide they were creating, rather than, you know, getting into the weeds, or not even the weeds, but just bringing up some other types of questions, right? Like, okay, we're debating single-payer healthcare. Well, like, what does that mean? And why do you oppose this or whatever? Instead of actually creating real conversation, they, as you said, were just focused on pitting candidates together and creating that divide, which I guess, like, maybe makes for, as Andrew Yang said on the second night, good reality TV. Yeah. But it just doesn't do anything positive. I will say, though, I was really impressed, and I think it might have helped Warren with her ability to actually take on what Delaney was saying and provide like kind of the context of why she thought what he was saying was wrong in a way that was like smart, concise, balanced, and like didn't come off necessarily as like very attacky but rather like, here is the policy and here's why I'm right. Like, I really enjoyed the way that she was able to do that.
Yes, she has consistently shown throughout this race that she can talk about complex policy in a relatable way and weave it into her sort of personal story. Found it really powerful when she brought up, you know, her family history and her having to go to community college and how it has informed her worldview. Like, she has, I think, one of the most compelling narratives. And also to format, I really liked when, because they really got into it on healthcare, and I think sort of egged on by CNN. And you know, it is good to have a healthcare debate, but I think she was really good at kind of being that adult in the room who sort of said, you know, reminding everyone that, you know, we're the Democrats. We're not about taking away anyone's healthcare. That's what the Republicans do. We're actually talking about the best way to provide healthcare. And I thought that like, it was just, I remember a moment that I thought was really powerful because it kind of elevated the conversation to, you know, where the party actually is, as opposed to kind of the reality TV spectacle that the night, you know, inevitably was going to be. So yeah, no, I continue to be impressed by her.
What you said about her ability to communicate complex policy, I totally agree. And I think that was really one of the biggest criticisms. And I don't like to make the comparison to Hillary Clinton because people do that far too often. But one of the biggest criticisms of Clinton was that she couldn't really do that. But Warren has actually built that into her whole narrative, right? She is the person with a plan. Like, she's got a plan for that. And I thought in comparison to... really, actually, I would say to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, like, I still have literally no idea what Joe Biden plans to do. Not a clue. Not one thing. Don't know.
Yeah.
And even with Kamala, like, I know, I've heard some of her plans, but she, I think, is focused so much on highlighting her record rather than the plans. So in comparison to those two candidates, I think Warren is, again, like heads above them on the policy discussion.
Yeah. What do you think of how Bernie did?
I thought it was interesting that there were a few cases where other candidates on the stage like made almost fun of his demeanor.
Oh, yeah. The Hickenlooper hands in the air moment.
Yeah. And then again, the like somebody, I can't remember who it was now, but was like, you know, well, I don't need to yell about it or something like that. And that was a like very much an attack on him. The other thing is he like swore a few times, which like were like bring the explicit content, I guess. But
I was struck in the first night by how Bernie's status as the writer of the Medicare for All bill had kind of made him. He sort of filled the role that Biden played on the second night, where he was kind of the person that people went after. And I actually thought his first debate performance I guess a month ago was not that strong. He kind of just went back to his talking points. He didn't really add a whole lot, but like when he was under fire, I actually found his kind of anger and how well he parried those attacks and how well he kind of just like held the stage and held the room and didn't sort of give an inch to these criticisms was compelling and actually kind of reminded me why he has won the ideological debate in the Democratic Party. And, you know, yeah, I'm not sure if it's like the best general election strategy or if he's the best candidate. He's second place in the race, so he's doing well. But, you know, I was sort of the opinion that the anger and sort of his brand worked for him on that night. The sort of the moderates that were attacking him didn't have as much, did not look as serious or as, I guess, as behind their proposals as Bernie was with his.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also kind of an interesting comparison to how Biden acted on the second night. Bernie, when he was attacked, he didn't turn around and be like, no, this person, this is why you're terrible. He was like, no, like I wrote the policy. This is why it's great. This is why it's awesome. And really, again, like stuck to his policy, stuck to his talking points. Whereas Biden was just like, he would turn around and just attack everybody. And like, that was so odd to me. I don't know why that's the strategy. And maybe I would have to guess that whoever is advising Biden is probably having a very hard time. And I assume he's like probably pretty stuck in in his ways and like opinion. So I assume that that's probably more his strategy than his people's strategy, but
yeah,
it just is a bad look.
I agree. And I think, so yeah, if we're talking about like Biden, the, like, I thought overall he sort of met expectations this time. He didn't, but I think that is bad for him because he is the front runner. And that exchange between him and Cory Booker, where he went after Cory Booker's record, and then Cory Booker, I thought, had his best debate moment of the time that I've seen him, where he just sort of tore into Biden and said he couldn't wrap himself in Obama's legacy when it was convenient. And I really thought that that was a powerful moment. A, coming from someone like Cory Booker, for who is, like, I probably think, president of the Obama fan club. Like, he's, you know, he's a guy who loves Barack Obama and has, you know, said so publicly several times. Yeah, and like, there were so many think pieces of the next day about why it is the Democrats are attacking the Obama legacy. But that's not how I read it, actually. I read it as a vulnerability for Biden, which I think is something that we're not, we spent a lot of time talking about how he's the front runner in like the media and in the world, in the punditry world. But I think his vulnerabilities are a little, are
glaring.
Yeah. They are glaring. And I mean, they are, like, he does seem stuck in the past, and, you know, like, he's trying to make that past the Obama legacy and not the, like, his time as a senator from the 80s. But people, and I thought Cory Booker showed this, is like, you can think that something is amazing. Like, you can look fondly back on the Obama years, and but not like want to go back to it. And I think Biden's core thesis is that Trump is an aberration. Let's just go back to the Obama days and what stuff was like. But like, I don't think that that's necessarily what people want. They don't want to go back to Obama.
I think the slate is being almost forced to attack the Obama legacy because they're trying to attack Biden, but because he's wrapping himself in the Obama flag, they are being almost forced to attack Obama, even when that's not really their intention a lot of cases. Because, and Biden does it, right? He's like, well, if you're the, it was President Obama that asked me to do that, so you're attacking him. And like,
like, come on, Joe. Like,
yeah, like, please just do me a solid here. Leave me out of it. I just want to talk a little bit more about some of the other folks on this stage on night one. So I now do have the list. I was able to find it. So it was Steve Block, Pete Buttigieg, John Delaney, we've talked about, John Hickenlooper, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Tim Ryan, Marianne Williamson, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. I guess, I don't know, I'm like, how do we even attack all of these?
I say we just do like, who stands out, good or bad?
Yeah.
Because as you were going through that list, I was like, who the hell is Steve Bullock and why was he there?
So true. And he got like, so actually, one of my tweets, I was like, less Steve Bullock, more Marianne Williamson. So the only reason I really said that was they were on either edge, right? And that's only the reason why I remember who he was. And they kept coming to him asking, again, like, kind of smart policy questions. And then they would be like, Marianne Williamson, just say something. And they weren't asking her questions or weren't tagging her back in. And I just think, like, yes, well, there have been many think pieces since, again, the debate on why she's so problematic.
That's some deep truth there.
Yes, exactly. But like, that I thought was, again, interesting. Like, why are you, if you're going to give somebody that's pulling at 1% time, you should probably give equally the amount of time to somebody else pulling at 1%. Like, that, again, I think gets back into like how these debates are being narrated. Like, again, Bullock was tagged in a number of times and Williamson wasn't. So I don't know, that just rubbed me a little bit the wrong way. And I will say, though, Marianne Williamson, she was a lot better this time than she was last time.
Oh, yeah.
And again, like, problematic in some ways, but she was definitely better than last time.
No, I agree. And that, I think that's a really important point about how they approached the candidates. Because, yeah, like, Bullock, who, like, was not in the first set of debates, has gotten into the race recently, is another moderate Midwest white dude, and the race has many of those with much better electability chances than Bullock. And yet they kept going back to him to draw a contrast. And I mean, like, yeah, and not Marianne Williamson. I think there is a gendered lens there that is important. And I also just the policy questions that Bullock did get, even though he's a governor, I think. Yeah. He had insane answers to.
Yeah, exactly.
When he said he would want to maintain the first strike Yeah. He didn't want to sign that. Actually, one of my favorite moments was when, like, Elizabeth Warren basically took apart why that was so dumb. Mm-hmm. And you could tell it was something he'd, like, never thought about before. And he was just answering on the fly on the stage. And it just reminded me of, like, every dude's don't get punished for that a lot of times in life, for just making stuff up as we go. And it was very gratifying to see, Elizabeth Warren, who has thought about everything very deeply, kind of take that apart.
So John Delaney, John Hickenlooper, Tim Ryan, and Amy Klobuchar, what, if anything, stood out of those four candidates to you, good or bad, I guess?
Hickenlooper continues to remind me of, like, your lovable but kind of embarrassing uncle. Like, he's never, or maybe like he's clearly smart, but, like, when he said that, like, trade policy can be therapeutic, or at the end of the debate when he said, what a night, I've loved it. Yeah. Like, it's just he always strikes a weird note that is, you know, somewhere between sort of too removed from reality and, like, but also maybe, like, too familiar in an uncomfortable way. Like, he always stands out in my head as sort of like a weird one. Tim Ryan actually had my moment of the night. His closing statement was sort of like, I hope I have inspired you. And, like, he'd spent the whole night being dunked on. Like, he was in the Delaney camp of basically moderates who were there on stage for Bernie and Elizabeth Warren to basically destroy, which they did. And then I'm gonna go back to this closing statement at the end. I was like, I hope I've inspired you. I actually laughed out loud and I woke up my dog. So CJ is not the biggest Tim Ryan fan. Klobuchar, I think, continues to be a person on stage who has a brand and she sort of stands, but she's not connecting.
But it's interesting too, because when you look at the list of candidates who have either made the September debate stage or getting close, like, she's up there in the getting close. So
she does have a very authentic brand and stage presence. Like, she seems like someone you could talk to. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really strong. But it's a brand that I think doesn't really work well with her policy set, which is definitely in the more moderate. Yeah. Like, she's running as a moderate Midwestern, I can win back Wisconsin and those Midwestern states that went for Trump. And I think there is an electability argument there. But I think one of the undercurrent, the thing that doesn't really make sense, is, like, this white Midwestern voter that in Michigan and Wisconsin who formerly voted Democrat and then voted for Trump, the Obama-Trump swings, like, they are, like, these are not people, I've seen no evidence that these are people who are motivated by, we just need a moderate. Like, I don't think they voted for Trump. They're not looking for moderate policy. Yeah. They're looking for change. And I think that's maybe why Amy Klobuchar is running, like, ringing a little hollow, is because I think she has that Midwestern brand that's great, but her policy set is too modern, too middle of the road. It doesn't say change enough. And I think that's what the voters that she's making the argument for are looking
for. Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think the other thing I find interesting about, and when I just named those four kind of candidates in the group, I was re-reminded of the difference-ish in the sense that in the US, there are lots of folks that run for president just to get their name out there. Whereas we don't see that in Canada to the same extent. Like,
yeah.
like, yes, maybe there's like a candidate or two that like will run for leader to get their name out there, but it's more they're the people that you're kind of hearing about in the background. They don't typically like mount these big campaigns and then just fade out into the background. So that, I think, because it's hard, like for me, when I'm like looking, I'm like, oh my God, how do all 20 of these people think that they could be the president of the United States? And then I'm like, well, I would say actually maybe 6 of them actually do. That's so interesting to me, and is, I think, in this particular case, perhaps a bit of a detriment to the Democratic Party writ large.
Because there are two parties in the states, and they're large organizations. Like our parties, I think in Canada, are smaller organizations, and there are some many negative things about that. But I think one of the positive things is like it's really hard to get taken seriously by a major political party in Canada unless you have some history in that party, unless you know the culture and you know the people. I mean, like, I think we saw, like, the closest analogy I can think of is when Kevin O'Leary ran for the Conservative leader and just got destroyed, because it turns out that you can't just go into a party, even the Conservative Party, like last second and say, hey, make me the head of this party, without any sort of history or real groundwork or showing that community people that you're serious.
Well, that's interesting. And actually, when I think about the Marianne Williamson thing, and like I said, I don't think that she needs to necessarily be taken more seriously, but two candidates that I would say are getting the biggest shaft on the debate stage would be Williamson and Andrew Yang. And Andrew Yang, actually, like, he's gaining traction, and they're still treating him like he's, you know, polling at 1% or whatever. And he's actually, like, he will be probably the next person to make the debate stage in September. Like, so.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And Andrew Yang actually gained the most Twitter followers after the debate, new Twitter followers. I love, and he had some great lines too. Like, I loved the opposite of Donald Trump is an Asian man who loves math. Like, everyone was talking about, you know, climate change and how, like, in this sort of particular way. And I actually really love that he brought the doom and gloom on that one. He was like, it's already too late. We need to be changed. Like, we need to be making, you know, we're not going to avoid climate change. It is already happening. We need to, like, adapt. And I actually thought that I like how truthful he is and how on message he is. And you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything. Like, I don't think UBI will solve all of the world's problems, but like he's a very interesting political force that I don't think the mainstream media treats
totally agree. And he was actually the very first presidential candidate that I followed on Twitter.
Early Yang Gang member.
And actually, like, honestly, the main reason why, so I, like, I am very in on, like, guaranteed basic income, and I saw, I was like, oh wow, there's this random guy who's talking about UBI exclusively and running for president, that's interesting, I'm gonna follow him. And that was literally that was kind of the only reason why I followed him. But I'm very interested in him. I'm in on Andrew Yang. And so we talked, I think, enough about John Delaney. I can't even name it.
That's gonna be a trivia slip up in like 20 years.
I'll lose like the 3 beers because I couldn't get his name right. So Pete Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke. We haven't talked, literally, I don't think we've said a word about either of them yet. They're interesting to me because, again, they're very much polling middle of the pack. I think Pete he's the top fundraiser, second only to Biden, if I remember correctly, which is super interesting. Yeah. And then, you know, Beto as well. I think he's disappointed probably, but at the beginning of the race, he was definitely, I think, somebody that people were excited about. So I would say, in my perspective, Mayor Pete continues to impress. Like, I think he was so good. Like, he was great on the stage. He had a great presence. He's bringing the kind of hope and change that Obama brought, really, like, in a sense. What is also kind of interesting is he's not really getting into the weeds on policy. Like, he keeps kind of coming back to his personal story and, like, those personal anecdotes, right? Whether it's like, you know, as mayor, this is something we've seen and this is why we need to change. which has its time and place, right? But I haven't really felt huge policy chops from him at this point.
No. What's really interesting about Mayor Pete is he can, like, yeah, I agree. He's an amazing communicator. And actually, like, in contrast to Biden, if Biden's thesis is I'm a moderate and I'll take you back to the Obama days, I think if you are a moderate voter and you're not looking, if you're worried about the Bernie Warren direction of the party's heading in, Mayor Pete and to a lesser extent Beto are giving you a model for what sort of a next generation moderate candidate mm-hmm. can sound like and look like. It's actually funny. When I was thinking through some of I was trying to remind myself of all of the candidates' policy positions on a bunch of issues in advance of talking to you today. Yeah, came back to Mayor Pete's positions on things, and he hasn't articulated positions on a lot of stuff. He's come up with really compelling ways of describing the issue. Like, he talks about being on the business end of climate change and we're the generation that needs to deal with. And I'm like, yeah, all right, what are we going to do? And then, you know, I think he has no real specific details on what he would do to fight climate change at all. Mayor Pete, I think, is a good presence on the stage, but it seems like, at least in the Democratic base, there's sort of a hunger for an agenda in a way that, you know, we're not just like,
I actually think back to the first debate where he did highlight a few policy positions. And I just remember, because I remember when I was sitting in my living room with a few friends being like, wait, I think he's talking about the free tuition program. We're like, wait, he's talking about a price on carbon. And going back to the, you know, very kind of recent Canadian type.
Yeah, Mayor Pete would be right at home. Yeah.
But I think in all of those cases, they are what I would maybe say practical center-left policies. But again, they're not the things that Warren or Sanders, they're not these big arching changes that they're presenting. So although probably in theory, the types of policies he is talking about are things that in a general, the Democratic Party is probably going to be talking about-ish. I just don't know, he's not making himself stand out there. But I think that goes back to what we kind of just talked about the fact that people run for other things while running for president of the United States. I would say both Pete and Beto are the two prime candidates for that. And I think that goes back to Beto being very center, moderate, whatever word you want to use. I think that probably really appeals to his home state of Texas. And that I think is probably where we're going to see him pivot to as the race dwindles. So I think that kind of is interesting too. When we talk about what the goals of these candidates are on the stage, I think that is definitely something to consider. Their goal is not necessarily to shape the presidential agenda, but to appeal to the base that they're actually looking for.
Absolutely. Mayor Pete, I think, is a fresh face, most, you know, moderate policies, moderate and progressive. But Beto is kind of all over the map on a lot of different things. He actually has, I think, the second most ambitious climate change plan of any of the candidates. He's only behind Inslee in the amount of money that he would pledge to fight it. It was the first policy that he led with. And I think it's interesting that he has this brand and parts of his agenda are quite progressive and seem like huge steps, and others are, you know, sort of moderate center left standard Democratic Party positions. And so I don't know, he as a political brand, I have trouble wrapping it up in a nice, neat little bow. The skateboarding moderate ex-punk rocker, but also really progressive on climate change and the border kind of guy. Like he's I'm curious to see what he does after this, because I don't think he's gonna be the nominee, but you know, like where he takes his career after this, I would not bet a lot of money.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting point. Yeah, but I don't know. I've probably honestly been let down most by Beto on the debate stage. If I had to like really pin a candidate that I was like interested in and they've let me down, it's probably Beto. Okay, let's wrap up debate one. We're like what, probably like a half hour and hour. I think there were more overall interesting moments on the second debate than there were the first debate. Like I just looked at all the candidates and I'm kind of like, oh well, yeah, I have something to say about this person, I have something to say about this person, I have something to say about this person. Whereas on the first night I really didn't. Like I thought a lot of people, those bottom kind of six or bottom four, really blurred together. But just again to refresh our memories on the debate stage on the second night, Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Kirsten Gillibrand, Michael Bennett, Andrew Yang, Bill de Blasio, Tulsi Garber, Jay Inslee, Joe Biden, and Kamala Harris. So definitely more of a diverse debate stage than the first night. But yeah, mm-hmm. I would say, I don't know, like I think what is interesting about that slate though, and I think in those hot takes afterwards, the fact that Bill de Blasio like is kind of one of the polling at the bottom, but he very much was really the only very left-leaning or like more kind of Bernie Warren-ite on that debate stage. So I think that was kind of an interesting piece to the puzzle. But yeah, I don't know. I thought the second debate had a more variety of topics. And I think the topics were even talked about a little bit more. So like criminal justice reform, for example, like I don't think that was mentioned like at all in the first debate. But that, as you mentioned with like Booker and Biden, that was one of the biggest moments of the night in the second debate. Booker definitely performed way better than the first debate. Like I was impressed by him for sure. Mm-hmm. I also think again, like Andrew Yang finally got some talking time, which I liked. And I will say his ability to pivot every single topic back in some way to guarantee basic income is like on point. Like it is crazy. Yeah. He would like start talking and I'd be like, how's he gonna do it? How's he gonna pivot this one back? And he would. And like, oh, like this is incredible.
Yeah. Oh my God. I think my favorite was like immigration. And he was like talked about like it's not immigrants, it's machines in the factories, and that's why like UBI will solve the immigration debate. And I was like, hold on.
Yeah, I was like, wow,
hold on, that was like some like that was like some, that was some ninja like debate stuff, right? Well,
even climate change too, I think. Yeah, I think it was immigration that I was like, how's he gonna bring this one back? But I think he did it on climate change too, and I was just like, wow, this is inspiring. Like your ability to pivot is like people are gonna study this. But yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I also thought, well, actually this is more broad, so he did not wear a tie again, and in his closing statement he was like, at the last debate, you know, media pundits spent all their time talking about how I didn't wear a tie on stage rather than talking about, you know, automation or universal basic income. But what I'd like to note, again, podcast called FemLonk, they're on the first night, or so Amy and Elizabeth both wore red blazers. And then people were tweeting about it, being like, oh, I guess the Democratic women shop at the same store. And I'm like, are you that everybody else on stage is just wearing like a dark suit? Like, that was, do they shop at the same store?
Dumb.
But even like on the second night, like I immediately, a whole bunch of tweets about Tulsi wearing like the white suit, being like, oh, power suit, so amazing, like looking great. And then even so, a Gillibrand coming out on stage in like a coral pink dress, I was like, wow, good for you. But I immediately, as soon as I saw her, I was like, well, you're going to be taken less seriously now. And isn't that so unfortunate that, again, like we focus, even when we've got this diverse set of candidates, they're still like focus on what they're wearing. But nobody talked, like, I didn't see an article about tie choices from the top four, or like, you know what I mean? But even again, the women who showed up in their dark suit, which were really Williamson and Harris, like nobody talked about that. So I think that's like, even though there is progress being made, like that it was something that was really striking to me.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that, and like continues to highlight in what I think is now a too large body of evidence that even in 2019, even in a world where we have women running for the highest offices in our societies, that they face hurdles that and lenses that men just don't. And what really is the most frustrating aspect of that for me is like it shows up into when it like starts bleeding into voter choices and electability. Like one of the things that consistently shows up as a worry that people have about Warren is basically that she's a woman and people want to have somebody that can beat Trump, and that they're worried that, you know, electing another woman won't do that. And people worry openly about this, and it shows up in polls. And it's like, you know, this electability question is just a cipher for so many different things. And it's, okay. Yeah, it's like, you know, I think spent a long time in politics patting ourselves on the back a couple of years ago about how far we've come, and we have come far, but we still have a really super long way to go. And some of the debate commentary really highlighted that for me too.
Totally. Well, and yeah, I mean, it's hilarious, the commentary being like, oh, well, Hillary lost, so can Warren do it? She's also a progressive woman. And I'm kind of like, well, you know, Trump is this terrible racist xenophobic human being, but you don't seem to have a problem electing another white man to go and take him on, right? Like,
oh yeah.
But actually, again, pull this back to the conversation in Canada, and I think we've seen in some cases of provincial government. So you worked for the Wynne government, which is, I would say, arguably one of, if not the most progressive government to like ever govern in Canada. I think maybe, I don't know, Notley might try to fight you for that category.
Yeah.
And then for me, I worked for Premier Brian Gallant, which, again, definitely the most progressive government to ever lead New Brunswick. And in both cases, both of those leaders, like, we lost re-election, and in both cases, the leaders stepped down. And I think it's interesting looking at who's running for the leadership of the Liberal Party in Ontario. It, again, is, if I remember correctly, and you would obviously know more, it's three men.
Three men currently. Yeah. And Mitzi Hunter is rumored to be considering it. And so I think she'd be a really welcome addition to the pool. And there's a strong draft Kate Graham.
Yes. Oh my God, let's get
shirt. Yeah, I would get that shirt. Actually, my debate night was basically made by both talking to you and Kate Graham. Kate sent me a variety of funny memes about John Delaney. I would buy a draft great Kate Graham t-shirt in a heartbeat.
Yeah, amazing. But again, like, so much of that dialogue, and both in New Brunswick, it definitely happened. So the now leader of the Liberal Party in New Brunswick is Kevin Vickers, who definitely nobody questions his long record of public service. But it, again, is so fascinating to me because in New Brunswick, it's a little bit of a different, well, it's actually kind of comparable to the U.S. in the sense Hillary won the popular vote. In New Brunswick, the Liberal Party won the popular vote by 6% and mm-hmm. so off, which is actually like wild. I don't know that any government has ever, or any party has ever won the popular vote by that many points and still not been governing. But so it's so odd to me that in that case, was still such a large course to kind of be like, oh, went too far to the left, you know, need somebody that is, you know, older, need somebody that is blah, 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 blah. When actually that progressive agenda won the most votes. So that, to me, I think is so odd. And I think, again, you guys would see that in Ontario a little bit as well, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah, and it's a weird mix. I mean, I think the party is, like, the Liberal Party in Ontario is still having a really active debate about how much of it was the identity of the leader, which really frustrates me, but is there. How much of it was our policy agenda, which also really frustrates me, but it is there. And how much of it was sort of voter fatigue with the, you know, a Liberal government that was in power for 15 years. And that of all of the things, I think, is the thing political movements are going to struggle with. Like going back to the Democratic Party, I mean, I totally understand why voters would look at I found it really interesting that moderates have struggled. And I think part of that might be, and this is just going out on a little bit of a limb, that they have a connection back to these political movements that have actually, you know, have done good things, but have not served people well in the past. And like, there's a distrust of institutions that is really palpable. And, you know, if you're part of the political establishment, it's probably harder to see that than it is for a regular voter. And, it's really interesting to watch this sort of dynamic play out in the States, where you have, you know, people who sort of fundamentally want to seem like, you know, Bernie, who wasn't a Democrat until really recently, might be leading that party. And I think it's because he has that outsider cred, and it's because he is seen as something sort of completely new. And I think attachment to a political movement of the past is a bigger inhibition, like across the Western world. And I think that is what you saw in Ontario and what you see sort of playing out in the Democratic Party right now. That's my sort of pet theory that I'm nursing right now.
Interesting. Yeah. And again, I think just trying to bring it back into the Canadian context as well. And you mentioned it earlier that the Democratic or the US, there are two parties, right? So in our case, in Canada, there are essentially three parties that are center left to far-ish left. So you have more of those spaces for, I guess, different views and decisions to go. Whereas in the Democratic Party, you kind of have all of those. So in, again, the Canadian context, the Liberal, NDP, and Green, all of those views finding a home-ish in one party, which I think goes back to it being very difficult to have those policy debates or discussions, and to see just the vast differences between those.
When I have watched the progressive versus moderate thing in the debate play out, I see a lot of the contours of the debates that happen between the Liberals and the NDP or the Liberals and the Greens in Canada. It's just, to your point, they're in one party in the States. And I'm wondering what you, like, do you think on the whole, net, it is better for progressive movements to have that structure? Or is it better to have the structure that we have in Canada where they're all in different parties? Because, yeah, I felt this is a very familiar tone in this debate that we've had in the progressive movement. Mm-hmm. Just it's happening within one party in the States and between many parties up here.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know. I don't know. I've never actually really put much thought into that. But I do think from an outside perspective looking in, it's easier for somebody without an attachment to like understand when there are three parties, like to kind of understand the differences in an easier way than what you are seeing a little bit in the Democratic Party, which is like, oh, well, some of them want a public option to healthcare, but they want to keep private insurers, to the other end of like, they want a full single payer, everything included option. Well, they don't even have their shit together inside the party. How the heck are they going to govern? That would be a negative for sure. And you see it in social movements broadly, right? Like you talk I think actually feminism often gets a bit of that kind of rep for how folks bring their feminism forward. Like there is differences and there's challenges within that movement. And again, it's an informal movement in that sense. So I don't know. I think it facilitates an easier understanding of the differences when there are kind of three. But that being said, like in Canada, I think you're seeing more and more similarities among the left than differences. So
it's better. I think it is better from a voter choice perspective, like because you can choose between a social democratic vision, sort of a liberal, sort of classic liberal vision, and then, you know, a super classic liberal vision with the conservatives. But the I do actually get a little bit jealous because the Democratic Party as one organization is going to is having to navigate this question of how far do we go, how progressive, you know, like they have to navigate this question and come out with one answer which they put towards the electorate. Whereas in Canada, I feel like, you know, we have two progressive parties that on many issues are not that far apart in the but both parties are vociferously undermining each other and playing up the those small differences mm-hmm. quite a bit. Like in Ontario, there are very few Liberal NDP swing ridings. Like I think it hurts us, the progressive movement electoral in Canada overall, and even if it is better for voter choice. And so part of me is a little jealous when I watch the stuff in the States, because I'm sort of like, you have this, it's just, they have a process where they figure it out themselves and they put forward one answer.
Yeah, no, I think that is interesting. And obviously, yeah, to your point, the experience in Ontario in the last election would have, I think, highlighted that particularly. I think on the federal side, it's a little easier to see the divides. In New Brunswick, we kind of still have a two-party system. There are four parties represented in the legislature, but the Green Party now. But that was actually like out of left field, which is super interesting. Like, you know, strategists weren't necessarily like, let's watch out for the Green Party. And that was, again, kind of blindside almost in the last kind of weeks of the campaign. But I think that is, it goes back to like what voters are looking for and what they're craving. And I think, yeah, in a lot of cases, they feel let down by the two, like kind of standard two parties. And so they are looking for a difference. And in the Canadian context, there is a little bit more of a place for them to go in comparison to the US, where, you know, if you're disenfranchised by the Democratic Party, where do you go?
Yeah, and that is the big con of, I completely agree with you, that is the big con of the Democratic, of the two-party system. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I guess I'm jealous of them for the one thing, but you take that with it, and that's also, like, the distrust of institutions in the States is so much higher.
Yeah, oh, totally. Well, and that's, like, I think in Canada, it's not even necessarily the distrust, but the disinterest in, like, in institutions broadly, because, you know, widely, and I say this widely, there are many caveats and examples here, but widely institutions have worked for Canadians. So they don't necessarily have this, they don't have an interest, because these things are working fine for them. So they don't have to like have this interest. But again, you see the folks that have a vested interest being the ones where the systems have failed them. Drastically. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know, it's I like I said, I haven't put a lot of thought into the party system in that way. We haven't talked really at all about Camilla.
No, which is funny, because all anyone was talking about was Kamala after the first one.
And yeah, so that is interesting to me. And actually, I was kind of interested towards middle of the conversation when I realized we hadn't talked at all about Mayor Pete. So that's interesting. I would say definitely the stage was attacking Camilla and Biden at a similar rate in debate two, which is interesting. But I think, yeah, what I really noticed most on the second night was, and I don't know how to frame it, like, I think back again that Harris is trying really hard to run on her record, and when you run on your record, you open yourself up, again, the same way that Biden is, to having people attack that record. So that, I think, was what I noticed a lot. And I noticed as well, when she was on the defensive, she was not great on the defensive. In the same way that Warren was, for example, on the defensive on night one, she, like, held her own. I did not necessarily feel that Harris held her own in the defensive.
No, it felt a little bit like Harris was not as loaded for bear as she was the first one. Like, it's almost, she actually seemed a little bit more Biden-esque, where, like, I felt like Joe Biden kind of sleepwalked into that debate, and I feel like Harris, she didn't quite seem like she was sleepwalking into it, but definitely did not have the same kind of like preparation for the criticism that was inevitably going to come her way, because she has elevated herself to so much through the debate format. Like, of course, people were after her, and she did not handle that well. I do think that that is interesting, because Harris, again, is someone who is more on the moderate end of the spectrum, is not really proposing big structural change. I mean, her top policy priorities are a middle-class tax cut, which kind of annoys me a little bit, because if you want to speak to that wealth distribution agenda, like, a tax cut is the least effective way of delivering it. But, like, she's kind of trying to, I think, have her cake and eat it too, like, campaign as a progressive in contrast to Biden, but her policy, I think, is more progressive than Biden's, but it's also not as progressive as many other people in the race. And she doesn't have a good answer for that line of attack yet. And also, yeah, sort of seems to bristle at attacks on her record that she should be prepared for. I think there's a good way of attacking them and being thoughtful about them. Mayor Pete did an amazing job, I think, responding to the criticism of his, you know, time as mayor and some of the racial issues in South Bend. And he seemed really honest and forthcoming when he said, you know what, I didn't get it done. It wasn't enough. Which he listed the things that he did try. And then, like, I believed that that answer made me convinced that he wants to do better than parts of his record.
Huge. Yeah, that's a huge thing. No. I think that Biden is missing. Like, he has not presented himself as humble at all, and actually the opposite. But I think you're right. Like, Camilla, I just even remember when Tulsi was, like, attacking her, and, like, it would cut to the look on Harris's face, and she was, like, almost, like, rolling her eyes, or, like, had this, like, kind of like, come on, like, this is like not at all true, yeah, blah blah blah, kind of like that is what I was getting from her. But yeah, so when Tulsi was like listing facts, like, she wasn't even really she was attacking her, but like she was saying facts. And so to have Harris like just basically being kind of like, come on, like, that was the vibe I got from her. I just thought it was like,
fair enough. I mean, I'm sure one thing that was rolling through Harris's mind is like, oh my God, you're literally a person who like is like, you know, praised Bashar al-Assad, like war criminals and stuff like,
exactly.
Like, yeah, like, why are you here? But yeah, like, I just completely agree with everything you said. You need in 2019, you need to have some humility. And be able to display that humility, and she didn't quite do it that night.
The other candidates I was interested in on night two, I actually really appreciated Jay Inslee. Yeah, and so it, like, I don't know, I was like very nervous that anything he said I was gonna feel like abrasiveness or something. But I don't know, I appreciate his contribution to the debate, because I think, differently from some of the night one folks we talked about, I definitely again think that he is not necessarily going to be the nominee, but at least he's coming to the debate or to the race with like, here is the issue I care deeply about. Yes, I have also views on other things that are progressive and I'm happy to share them, but this is what I care about. I'm going to talk about this, and this is an important topic. And so I appreciate that he is like, I don't know, I appreciate his voice in the debate. And I think, yeah, that was really reiterated to me in this round.
I think so too. I thought he had a pretty good debate as well. Jay Inslee has, I think, the only climate change plan that is. So yeah, like, he's there to talk about climate change, and it's an interesting strategy. His plan is really, really, really good. It has five sections. It's the $9 trillion over 10 years to completely transform the U.S. economy, move it in an extremely rapid way to carbon neutrality. He also brings in economic and social justice through, looks at it through a climate change lens, and how in this transition do we ensure that those who are going to be impacted by climate change the most, and who tend to be low income, you know, are not left out. Like, he has really put a lot of thought into it that I really wish, like, this debate stage is just not a good platform to get into that. But, like, you know, yeah. I hope that whatever candidate wins just, like, looks at the policy work that he's done and adopts that as their climate change plan, because it is truly transformative. I contrast him in an interesting way, and I'm very curious for your thoughts on this, to Elizabeth Warren, who has taken the opposite approach to climate change. Jay Inslee is there to basically talk about climate change as a sole issue. Elizabeth Warren doesn't really have climate change as a sole policy. She doesn't have "here's my climate plan" in the way that she has other things. She's woven climate into a narrative, into kind of her other plans, and is looking at, you know, if she's kind of looking at the race through the corruption and systemic economic change, and sort of the way she talks about climate change is as a product of big money in politics. And I think they are two really, really interesting candidates who are approaching climate change, which is one of the defining issues of their time, and they both acknowledge that, but in really different ways. And I kind of feel like it's going to be an interesting test case for how politicians should talk about climate change, because I think Inslee has struggled to get the depth of his message through, whereas Elizabeth Warren has talked about climate change, but through a lens that seems to really be connecting with people in this format, in this modern political ethos, even if it is not in a as, you know, deep and focal a way as Jay Inslee has.
Yeah, so I remember actually after the first debate, I think I was listening to the Weeds podcast, the Vox podcast, and they highlighted the fact that Elizabeth Warren, you know, has a plan for everything, but at that point, and I actually don't know if she's released one, to be honest, I didn't check, at that point, she didn't have a plan for healthcare. Like, she basically was like, yeah, like, she just continues to say, you know, yeah. It's kind of like, yeah, my plan is like Bernie's plan. But so I think that, and their kind of point was, the statement she's making by not having a plan is just as big as the statement she would be making by having a plan, like whatever the plan statement would be. And I think that is probably very similar in the case of climate change. Like, by not having a plan, she's making more of a statement, particularly because she has so many plans. And again, in this case, I don't think it's a good one. I also kind of contrast it to when she has been asked about either universal basic income, guaranteed basic income, whatever. She actually says she's against it because she thinks that they should do all these other things first, right? Like, get corruption out of the system, get everything on track, and then we can talk about this guaranteed basic income, which I think is an interesting approach. Mm-hmm. And it sounds a little bit like that is her approach on climate, right? Like, well, if we tackle these problems, we will in turn be tackling climate change because we're getting the money out of these corporations. We're cutting them off at the knees. We're doing all these things. These big polluters won't have the kind of legs to stand on anymore. So I don't know. I don't know about that approach, but I think, yeah, I think your point that we'll see kind of what resonates better is a good one.
Elizabeth Warren has five like plans right now that mention climate change and have climate change as a proposal in them. And so it's interesting to see what voters generally bite at more. Is it better to talk about climate change as an issue or to look at it as multiple things?
Yeah. So the only, or the kind of other big thing I'd like to talk about second night was that gender issues actually came up, or roughly. Crazy to think that there was, you know, what was it, 6 hours of debate basically, and I think maybe 5 minutes if that was spent on issues impacting, specifically impacting women. And what was also interesting is the question was asked to Andrew Yang.
That was after I turned out, but
yeah, Don't you worry, he pivoted back to guaranteed basic income.
I mean, so. could have seen that one coming. That is almost as good as in the first night when the moderator with a straight face was like, I think asked a very, like, what can we do to bridge the racial divide in this country? And then turned to John Hickenlooper, who's like, all right, when I think of people who have answers to solve the racial divide, John Hickenlooper is my first. He's my go-to.
And I mean, yes, like, obviously, do I think every candidate, all 20, should have specific, like, equality positions? Yes. Do I think they should also have, like, you know, absolutely, solving the racial divide positions? Yes. But is that the right person to ask on the stage? I don't know. And so I think perhaps, so the question was about the pay gap, the gender pay gap. And so on the one hand, asking Andrew Yang, the person talking about guaranteed basic income, sure, I'll let you off the hook. But it was very odd. And the other very unfortunate thing is they framed the question as, you know, women in the US make 80 cents on the dollar. What are you going to do about this, basically? And again, he had a very good answer. He also does have a kind of a good plan, and it works really well into the universal basic income, where he talks about valuing of caregiving work, and he relates it to his own personal experience. He has a kid with autism, or two kids, one with autism, and his wife, I think, is the stay-at-home primary caregiver, and he talks about, you know, why is her work in our society not valued at all? So he kind of pivots that in, and that's great, and we need to be talking more about that. So he had an okay answer, but then they asked Harris to respond, basically. And this was, in my opinion, a great moment for her of the night. She just started listing off. She was like, yeah, white women make 80 cents on the dollar, and black women make, and like, it just kind of disaggregated that data, which is so important, because that's, again, like, yeah, in the case of the pay gap, white women are the lucky ones, right? So that was important. But then, because her plan is basically to make corporations pay if they demonstrate a pay inequality in their workplace. Again, volleyed over to Gillibrand, what are your thoughts on this? And she pivoted it to reproductive health, which I think is so interesting that, again, in this debate, it did come up in the first debate about the abortion bans happening across the US, but didn't come up at all on this one. So she pivoted to that and then took it as an opportunity to attack Biden. But she attacked him for like an op-ed he wrote in the 80s about women, like, I think the exact quote is something along the lines of like, women who work out of the home are like defacing the value of, or like something like that, of the family. And she took the opportunity to attack him on that, where I'm kind of like, look, what Biden said in the 80s on gender equality is not super relevant compared to what he said, you know, recently on gender equality. And so again, Camilla tapped back in on the Hyde Amendment. So it was like, these were kind of all of the conversations happening, but I just thought it was a little bit of a missed opportunity to attack Biden again on his positions from the 80s. And we keep seeing that, right? Like, he keeps getting attacked on what he did, you know, 30, 40 years ago, instead of like challenging him on what his policy positions are now, or even what he has done recently. And I think, again, like, it is unfortunate that Gillibrand, who is, I would say, probably the biggest feminist on the stage, for her to take that time to attack something that really was seen a little bit as a way to score political points, which could have challenged him again on, like, what is he going to do to ensure that, like, a woman's right to choose is not under attack if he is president, or whatever, right? Like, she could have decided to pull him in, or to challenge him on something a bit more relevant. Not to say he shouldn't be challenged on that, but that was kind of my take there.
Interesting thing about the second night is it had less viewers substantially than the first night. I think the first night was like 15 million odd I think, and it dropped about 10 million. So it like, there was a substantial drop in viewership back to, this was a long and frustrating thing to watch. But I think like the second night, the part of it that I did catch was more frustrating to watch, because it did seem like the candidates were going after each other's policy differences less, current policy differences less, and each other's records more. And it just felt bad afterwards. Like, it's sort of like, you know, if you're a progressive who's kind of rooting for one of these people to become the next president, like, it does not feel bad to have them have a substantial disagreement about healthcare, for instance, and talk about their current position and what we should do. Like, that feels important and like a good discussion to have. Who is the most sexist, most racist person on stage based on something that happened 20 years ago? Well, I think is an important part of the conversation. I agree. Like, it that makes it seem like it's hurting the movement a little bit more than you know, like, hell, even attacking Joe Biden's recent comments about race, and like that, that for me is a very important thing to talk about in the context of this race. Stuff from the 80s, like, I thought the second night was nastier and felt worse. And I actually, you know, part of the reason that I didn't watch the whole thing was A, because I had an appointment that I needed to go to, but B, I was like kind of happy to turn it off. I was like,
yeah. Yeah, no, I totally agree. But yeah, that's it. And I think, again, like, some of the other criticisms, like Biden's on race, like, Harris was able to say, you know, you said this recently, and that was, you know, offensive to me because, oh, and also here are the record, like, here's your record on this issue. Like, that very much could have been the way that you challenge Biden on, like, women's equality, right? Like, here is what you've done or said recently, because he also, like, has not disavowed his support to the Hyde Amendment. He didn't on stage either. So you very much could have pulled that recent piece in and said, oh, and by the way, here is your habit on this.
And
so, like, you challenge it that way. Because, again, like, who, like, how do you even have that op-ed from the 80s? Like, that was her oppo team definitely dug into that, found it, and they decided to use that.
Yeah,
like,
no, yeah, it feels, it feels there is obviously still a modicum of respect between these candidates, because no one went after Biden on gender and on his creepy behavior. And that is, I think would have brought it to kind of like a whole other level of nastiness. And part of me is glad it didn't go there. But also, I mean, his response to that, and when that became an issue for him, like, he apologized, but it was kind of a, I'm sorry if you felt like this was this kind of thing, and that for me was when I was like, no, like, if I were in the States, I would never vote for Biden. Like, if you can't acknowledge that this, like, inappropriately touching women at public events is something that you should not do, then I just don't know how you're gonna.
Well, and I think even at, I don't know if you saw the commentary, but at the very beginning when he shook hands with Kamala Harris, he said, go easy on me tonight, kid. And, like, I'm sorry, do you think he would have said that to even, like, Mayor Pete, who is obviously the youngest in the race?
Yeah.
Like, it would have been shocking, right? So that is, I totally agree. There's a way of criticizing him on his record on women's equality, and that just is not it. I think also, though, you made a good point about kind of protecting Biden. I think that goes back to this huge issue with the Democratic Party right now, where it feels that they're so focused on, like, who can win against Trump that they don't even care about having those big policy debates, or even, you know, like, the argument around impeachment right now too, right? Like, they're so focused on how do we beat him that they're not caring at all about what is the right thing to do right now. And, like, with the argument with Biden, everyone keeps being like, oh, he's the front runner. Yeah, he's the front runner because there's 20 other candidates in the race. And if you add all of their support up, he's not the front runner, right? Like, he's only polling at, I think, like, between 25 and 30%. All you need is two of the other second place candidates. Like, that is their support there, right? So that, I think, is, like, interesting and not getting a lot of discussion, right? Like, he's the front runner because the support is divided between everybody else right now. And once people do start to drop out of the race, that's going to tighten up really quickly, I think. And that's a whole different conversation. Does America really change that much with Joe Biden?
No, and like, I think there's a couple really interesting things in what you just said. I thought Mayor Pete actually had the best line on that, which is that, you know, if we campaign on Medicare for all, they're going to call us a bunch of crazy socialists. And if we campaign on anything else, they're going to call us a bunch of crazy socialists. So let's like decide what we believe. Kind of ironic coming from Mayor Pete, who does not have a set position on, or no, he has a set position on healthcare. Sorry. It's a little ironic coming from Mayor Pete, who is probably one of the more policy light of the candidates. But I thought it was a really powerful statement and a reminder to the room that, like, you know, Republicans are going to call you crazy no matter what. So, you know, why not lead with your values? I was reading a really interesting thing by Ezra Klein about how it is common wisdom in the United States that moderates, the American electorate, will punish people with extreme viewpoints. So, and like, it's why this moderate versus progressive dynamic is being set up in this race and being covered by the media, because there's an assumption that a more moderate candidate will appeal to more voters and be able to win over independents and will have a better chance of winning. But what is, they've, in two sort of recent studies, in 20, one from 2019 and one from 2017, there's, going back into historical like record, there's actually not a lot of evidence that that is the lens through which voters look at the race. And when they've done these polls of like Biden versus Trump or Bernie versus Trump, it is you don't actually see a lot of daylight. Biden is pulling the highest versus Trump. Bernie is second place. Warren is third, I think. And they pull together very similar coalitions of voters, and they appeal to kind of that, you know, no matter what the position is. And like, I think we're seeing a really interesting moment where that assumption that it is a more moderate candidate who, you know, might be a man or whatever it is coming under some question. Because Joe Biden is very different than Bernie Sanders, and yet they're pretty similar in how they're polling against Trump, and like with the same pool of voters. Like it's I think it's, this whole race should really cause us to question some of the assumptions we make about electability in progressive politics.
Arguably the two most well-known candidates in the race right now, right? Like, even though Warren has been around a long time, she's not super well-known. And then even Harris, even less so, I would say. So I think it goes back a little bit to that, right? Like it's a little bit more about the fact that these are the two candidates that are just the most well-known. And particularly, I think that is supported by what you're saying. Like, they are definitely on either end of the progressive spectrum. So if they're pulling the same, I think it's more about the overall just knowing of the candidate rather than
you want to know my favorite factoid about that is that Elizabeth Warren is by far polling the highest amongst high information voters. So people who are following this race on a daily basis, she's beating Biden and Bernie, which is why I think her momentum is so high. Bernie and Biden voters tend, Biden is actually second place amongst high information voters, and Bernie is third, which I think is a really interesting dynamic.
Do you think because high information voters are probably voters that are very much like, in my mind, the rationalization there is like, oh, well, you know, we don't think that Bernie can win, so Biden will be the second.
Like, I think it's, and to your point, as more people tune in, does the race start looking more like the high information voter pool than it does right now? Because going back to our thoughts on the debate as a whole, like, I love politics. I'm really glad I don't need to watch another debate like that. And you know, I can totally see a person who maybe is a little bit less into this topic than you or I am, looking at the race and saying, like, I'm going to tune in when there's a few more less people on stage, and you know, they're not thinking about it that hard right now.
Yeah, definitely. So on the topic of debates, it was recently announced in Canada for the federal election, there will just be two debates hosted, one English and one in French. And that'll be hosted by the kind of new media group, new debate group, whatever the heck it was called. That's basically just a conglomerate of the media organization pulling together to host one rather than them each kind of hosting their own. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, particularly in this context where we've now seen two and in the Democratic primary, and I think we'll be seeing a lot more.
Yeah, I think that while I have been criticizing throughout this whole conversation the crazy format that they have in the States right now, I think that like this debate format is way too far on the other end of the spectrum. Like, one of my big complaints, and we had on Ontario Loud Taylor Scollin from North 99 on, and one of the things we were talking about is how much further behind we are in Canada at getting the leaders in front of people in the States. Like, I follow Jagmeet Singh, Justin Trudeau, I don't follow Andrew Scheer on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, also, you know, several of the presidential candidates, and I hear so much more from the presidential candidates than I do from any of the Canadian leaders. And when I think about, like, we are going to have there's some massive policy questions on the table in this election, like taxing carbon. Are we going to go forward or backward on climate change? Are we going to where we're going to go on truth and reconciliation? Like, there are some, we're kind of at a serious crossroads on a number of significant policy issues, and I just do not see like one debate doing justice to the difference between the parties. As you sort of recited that format to me, it was the first that I have actually heard about it, but my first reaction has been exceedingly negative, and I continue to be frustrated by the reluctance of Canadian politicians to spend significant amounts of time getting in front of voters and talking about issues in a detailed and serious way. We don't need 10 people on stage. It's probably maybe a good thing that we don't have 10 people on stage yet, you know, like yelling at each other, but one English and one French night for a federal election just seems to me to be, for a country this big.
Because I think too, even like we just in this conversation have referenced back and forth to the first debate versus the second, and like who performed well, who didn't. And even again, just look at Kamala Harris being the one I think benefited most from the first debate. And then probably she'll probably be, if I had to guess, the one that will have benefited least of the front runners from this second debate. So that I think is interesting too, right? Like if you have a leader that has a bad night and there's only one debate, because let's be honest, people aren't going to watch, very few people will watch both the English and the French debate. And if they do, I would probably call them high information voters. So that probably isn't going to sway their opinion anyways. But yeah, like if the leader has a bad night, the first night, like that actually, I would want to get back up on the stage. Like if I'm the leader in probably at least the Conservative and the Liberal Party, like I want a second chance. Is that fair?
And it like really frustrates me because it is going to let them get away with sound bites on all of the major policy topics.
It'll be the most theatric thing ever because they'll spend all of their time just on this one thing. They're gonna have talking points that they want to get in. They're gonna like pivot, and I don't know actually. It wasn't clear to me if they've set rules yet of who will be on the stage. I think based on polling, there's likely no question that Elizabeth May will be on the stage, but like, will Maxime Bernier be on the stage? But even still, back to your point, then we have three progressive parties fighting over the nuance of their policies with one conservative basically taking up all the air. And what will happen, like, people, the Green Party is probably not going to sit there and attack Scheer. They're going to sit there and attack the NDP and the Liberals and vice versa. Like, I think it's just, I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. I don't understand it. If I were actually, like to your point, both Justin Trudeau and Andrew Scheer, I would want multiple debates on topics that were important. I don't think the conservatives would want a climate change debate, for instance, but I think the liberals would. But you could probably find some topics like the economy, or I think both the conservatives and the liberals would want to talk about the economy, the environment, maybe not climate change, but if you were just call it the environment and allow the the conservatives can talk about how much they think the carbon tax is stupid, and the liberals it's really frustrating to me, because it's going to be short sound bites, no nuance, that's really frustrating news.
I agree.
I don't know, people have spent a lot of time worrying, I think, about the Democratic debate process in the states, as they spent a lot of time worrying about the Republicans debate process back in 2016, whereas it seemed like, there was having a lot of division and a lot of conversation, you sort of keep coming back to it, was a bad thing. But, they were able to, giving the voters a lot of time to get to know the candidates is ultimately ended up assisting, even if the debates themselves were a little bit messy, ultimately ended up assisting the Republicans when it came time to the general mm-hmm. election. And then ultimately ended up, we'll see what happens with the Democratic debate.
Yeah. But
I'm just not sure if the lesson from this modern political moment is that you need to shield yourself from public scrutiny. I think the public might react.
Yeah. Well, I also think too, with more debates, there's more options for many topics. I assume this will be maybe a 2-hour debate, say. So you only are going to get a handful of topics, right? You'll get the economy, you'll get climate, hopefully you'll get climate, but you'll get the economy, you'll get healthcare, maybe you might get the immigration. You're not going to get a wide variety of topics. So then you'll have things like, one of the things we don't talk about at all in federal campaigns really is international relations, things like that that are important that is probably not going to come up on the debate stage when there's one debate, right? So I think at your point, we just don't get to hear these robust policy debates from our leaders in Canada at all.
The conservatives will probably sneak in a line about Justin Trudeau being soft on China. And there will just not be as much time. What really makes that line of inquiry sound hollow is when you actually have some time dedicated to the topic and then ask Andrew Scheer, okay, well, what is your China plan? What would you do differently? Mm-hmm. It's not enough to just say, the format will actually benefit the criticisms that have less substance to them, because Andrew Scheer, it benefits him to say Justin Trudeau is weak on China. What they're proposing does not really match the outcomes and the expectations they're setting for themselves. And so I think it's also going to reward those who are sort of going to attack the liberals for things that they themselves don't really have a substantive policy answer for, and it will penalize the liberals. It'll give the liberals less time to respond in a substantive way.
So I think it is fair to say we've definitely gotten to the weeds a bit on the Democratic debates and many different rabbit holes perhaps too. But I really enjoyed this conversation. And again, thanks Chris for joining me. I'd also just love to let folks know a bit more about Ontario Loud. I love the podcast. I listen, I think, every week. I find a lot of value from the work that you're doing there. So I'd love if you would maybe just tell folks where to find you and the team. And then we'll wrap up the conversation.
Well, thank you so much, for having me on FemWonk, Katie. Likewise, I'm a regular listener of FemWonk, and I love what you're bringing to the Canadian political podcasting scene. So thank you for having me on. It's been a real treat to talk to you and be here. Ontario Loud is a weekly conversation about Ontario politics and public policy. We also talk about federal stuff a little bit, and occasionally dip our toe into U.S. stuff when we can't help ourselves. It's had between a bunch of recovering political staffers. You can find us at ontarioloud.ca or on Twitter at twitter.com/ontarioloud. On any major Ontario or on any major podcast provider. I think our podcast might have come out on the same day,
Very close, yeah.
or like Very, very close in line. And I'm really, really happy to be on here, because one of the things that we, when we were thinking about starting a political podcast, is like realizing that everything we listened to was US based and how little content there is from a Canadian politics. But in from sort of a public policy practitioner perspective and people who've worked in politics and government, you know, we didn't see that kind of scene in Canada. So we're really, really, really happy to see more of that coming out. And, you know, FemWonk is a big part of that. And so I'm a regular listener, and, you know, if you're listening to this, you're already listening to FemWonk, but I'm really excited for, you know, some potential collaborations we're going to do in the future.
Definitely. Well, that's like something I found so interesting as well. I remember seeing the podcast again when it first came out, and I actually initially was a little bit nervous because I was like, oh no, are we going to create very similar products? And what I think is so beautiful about both of the kind of niches that we have, sometimes we talk about similar topics, but I don't think we've had much kind of overlap in our analysis and in things like that. So I think, to your point, there's lots of room for more of these discussions in the Canadian context. And I'm super excited to see where Ontario Loud goes and what those kind of topics look like. And I think, again, like from our perspective, we're constantly like iterating. And when there's something interesting that we like, even if it's the US presidential debate, US Democratic debates, we can kind of cover it and bring in that Canadian lens. Yeah. So yeah, I'm super excited to see where Ontario Loud goes as well. And yeah, thank you again so much for spending lots of time with me today.
As always, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FemWonk. You can also subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and feel free to email us directly, katie@femwonk.com. Thanks so much.